Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
A little less than a century ago, members of the Osage Nation were the object of national envy. They had struggled to eke out a living on a patch of land considered too rocky to be coveted by white farmers. But it turned out that bad real estate sat atop an enormous oil deposit. And by the early 1920s, they were among the wealthiest people in the world. And then the murders began. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Over the course of a few years, dozens of people in a community of just 2,000 Osage were shot, beaten, bombed, and poisoned. And while an investigation serious enough to stop the violence took a while to get underway, it would ultimately demonstrate the courage of the Osage who survived and helped to establish J. Edgar Hoover's fledgling law enforcement agency. Author David Grand tells these dual stories in his book, Killers of the Flower Moon: The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, which he talked about with Chris Boyd. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
This is such an extraordinary story, and the way you were drawn to it is nearly as interesting. You saw this panoramic photograph.
Yeah, so in 2012, I went out to the Osage Nation in northeast Oklahoma. And when I was there, I went to the museum and I saw this great panoramic photograph. It looked very innocent. It showed members of the tribe along with white settlers. It was taken in 1924. But when I was looking at it, I noticed a part of the photograph had been cut out, as if someone had taken a scissors to it. And I asked the then museum director what had happened to it. And she said it had contained a figure so frightening that she decided to remove it. And she then pointed to the missing panel and she said the devil was standing right there. And the book really grew out of trying to understand who that figure was and the history he embodied.
I'm so surprised that this story is not something that everybody in America knows.
Yeah, when I first learned about the story back then, I did not know that the Osage Indians of Oklahoma had become the wealthiest people per capita in the world because of oil under their land. I did not know that they were mysteriously murdered. And I did not know that the case had become one of the FBI's first major homicide investigations. And I think the same way many of the murders were neglected in their time, I think this part of history has also been neglected because of prejudice, because it really is one of the most sinister crimes in American history.
Even if the murders had not happened, of course, that would have been a happier history, but the Osage Nation has a fascinating history. Can you first of all talk about what life was like for them before they moved to northeast Oklahoma?
Yeah. So the Osage had once controlled the central part of the country. In the 1800s, President Thomas Jefferson referred to them as the Great Nation. They extended their land all the way from Missouri, what is today Missouri and Kansas, all the way out to the edge of the Rockies. And then, like so many Native American nations, they were driven off their ancestral lands. Over a period of a few decades, they had to cede more than 100 million acres. And they were bunched up on a reservation in Kansas. And in the 1860s, were once more under siege by white settlers. And it was at that time that an Osage chief, he stood up and he said, we should move to Indian Territory, what would later become Oklahoma, because the land is rocky. It's infertile. The white man can't do agriculture, and so he'll finally leave us alone. And so the Osage purchased that land. It was about the size of Delaware and resettled in northeast Oklahoma. And then, of course, lo and behold, the seemingly forsaken territory turned out to be sitting upon some of the largest deposits of petroleum in the United States.
It's no small detail that they purchased that land.
Yes, it's critical. They had a deed to their land. So the federal government forced many American Indian reservations to be allotted, which essentially meant breaking up the reservations, divvying them up into private parcels, and turning American Indians into private property owners, which would, of course, make it easier to procure their land. And when they tried to do that with the Osage had much more leverage because they owned their land. They had a deed to it. And so in 1906, when they were forced to be allotted, they were led by one of their greatest chiefs, a man who spoke seven languages, including Latin. And he slipped, along with other Osage leaders, a very seemingly curious provision into their allotment treaty, which said that we will maintain control of all the subsurface mineral rights under their land. Now, nobody knew at that time they were sitting upon a fortune. They had some hints there was petroleum, but they very shrewdly managed to hold on to this last realm of their land, which they could not even see.
What told them there might be petroleum there?
An Osage Indian in the 1890s had actually been at a creek on the territory, and he noticed a rainbow sheen floating on the surface. And a white trader came and looked at it and like took a little bit out, and they realized it was petroleum. So it was the first hint that they were sitting upon it. But again, even by 1906, when they were allotted, and 1907 when Oklahoma became a state, there was no sense yet that these massive deposits. But the Osage, because of that treaty, they became the world's first underground reservation, because their surface territory rapidly disappeared into the hands of whites, but what was underneath they maintained collectively.
They had a really good lawyer fighting for them.
They had a good lawyer, and they had very shrewd leaders at the time to do this.
So when oil was discovered, they weren't rich overnight, but very rapidly they started to accrue great wealth.
Yeah. So it's important to understand that the Osage numbers had dwindled significantly by the time they settled in Oklahoma because of disease, because of forced migrations, massacres. And by 1906, during this allotment treaty, there were only about 2,000 Osage who were on the tribal roll. And each one of them was given what was called a headright. And essentially, a headright was a share in this collective mineral trust. And early on, when a little oil was tapped, if you had a headright, you might get a check every 4 months for $100. Then that grew to $1,000. Then it grew to into the millions. And by 1923, in that year alone, those 2,000 or so Osage collectively received what would be worth today more than $400 million. They had become the wealthiest people per capita in the world.
What did they do with that money?
They lived in terracotta mansions. They had chauffeur cars. They had servants, many of whom were white. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 of them. And of course, this belied longstanding stereotypes of Native Americans that could be traced back to the first brutal contact, the original sin from which the country was born. And so reporters, society reporters, would travel out to the Osage Nation and regale the readers both with these stories of the Osage wealth. And this provoked both envy and prejudice and all sorts of reactions among other people in the country, other white members of the country.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily being any showier than you and I might be if we suddenly came into that kind of money. But white people surrounding that space with the mineral rights just couldn't bear it.
They couldn't bear it. There was a great deal of envy. There was a great deal of outrage and prejudice, to the extent that, I mean, the Osage were really scapegoated for the wealth. It's really important to understand the context. This is the 1920s, the era of the Great Gatsby, the era of prolificacy. Some of the oil men who were white, you know, made fortunes and blew them. And yet somehow the Osage wealth became a topic of national concern. And members of Congress would scapegoat them. They would literally sit in these committee rooms. And you could read the testimony today. And it's just kind of hard to believe. It's mind-boggling. And they would discuss, what are we going to do about all this Osage with their wealth? How can they handle their wealth? What are we going to do with their wealth? And they had passed legislation requiring many Osage to have white guardians to oversee and manage their money. And this really was a deeply racist system. Quite literally, it was based on the quantum of Osage blood. If you were a full-blooded Osage, you were deemed, quote-unquote, incompetent, and you were given one of these guardians who then could tell you, even if you were a great chief who had led a nation.
And spoke seven languages.
Yeah, spoke seven languages. You had somebody telling you, you know, this is how you're going to spend your fortune, down to the toothpaste you bought at the corner store. And it should be added, not only was the system racist, it really created one of the greatest state-sanctioned criminal enterprises in American history, because many of these guardians turned out to be crooks who pilfered money and got kickbacks and downright just often embezzled millions.
Who were these guardians and who were they accountable to?
What's so interesting is they were often the most prominent members of society. They were often lawyers, bankers, businessmen. They were appointed by judges, and judges would often, and they were overseen by the Department of the Interior, and they were overseen by state judges as well. And there was even a patronage system. If you were a politician or a judge running for office, you would often offer people, "I can get you a guardianship in return for votes." So it was referred to as, quote unquote, the Indian business.
And that guardianship came with a fixed amount of money that you received every month for your trouble.
Exactly. Not only did you get money, but there were so many ways. I mean, one of the ways there was basically two pricing systems. If you were Osage, you had a separate pricing system. But one of the things the guardians would often do is they would would say, okay, you want to get a car, purchase the car at this store. And then at that store, they had a relationship with the owner who would then give them a kickback. Hmm. So that was even that was on the modest level, but that was just commonplace.
Did your research find that the guardians were universally venal? Were there any that actually tried to do the right thing?
There were. There definitely were. And it's good not to paint everything in such broad brush. I mean, there certainly was some paternalism among some of them and would have had racially insensitive attitudes. But they certainly they were not all crooked and stealing. But a large portion of them were, and they were unregulated, and they got away with it. And it's and the system itself was just kind of outrageous on its face. But what so often happened, what you realize with a system like this is often behind the veneer of enlightenment, this kind of this paternalistic enlightenment was a fist of coercion.
What was happening to the culture of the Osage Nation at this time when they, like many other American Indian tribes, were being forced to educate their children away from home?
Yeah, I mean, I write a lot in the book about a woman named Molly Burkhardt, who's really a remarkable woman. She was born in the 1880s in a lodge, speaking Osage, practicing Osage traditions. Because of oil money, within a few decades, she's living in a mansion with white servants and a white husband. But she was typical in that she was forced by the government to attend a Catholic boarding school when she was just about seven. She was uprooted from the lodge she lived in. She was put in the back of a wagon and taken to the farthest place she had ever been across the reservation and put into a Catholic boarding school where she suddenly had to remove her Osage blanket. She had to catch the white man's tongue. She was given a Bible with a totally different worldview. And so many of the Osage were forcibly unmoored from their traditions. And the money and the wealth accelerated that then later because so many white settlers were drawn into Osage County because of the money. These became wild boom towns. So there was a great deal of intermarriage at that period.
With the kind of money that they had access to, even in this paternalistic system, I wonder how much the Osage bucked against this, all these rules that were imposed upon what they owned.
Yeah, no, they fought and resisted. They testified before Congress against the guardianship system. I found statements from an Osage chief saying, you know, stop, this is an injustice. We are not children. We are men. And you know, we should not be treated this way. But the law and the power resided with members of Congress. And so despite these efforts and fighting, and sometimes they would have some success at limiting it, but nonetheless, despite their efforts, the U.S. government imposed these rules upon them.
I feel like people are going to read this book and name their daughters Molly in the next few years. She really was remarkable. You mentioned that she married a white man. How did they meet and fall in love? Yeah. What was their relationship like?
So in many ways, she straddled not only two centuries, but two civilizations. And she met a man named Ernest Burkhardt, who was typical of many of the settlers who arrived. He came from Texas. Drawn by the money. His uncle was already a cattle baron in Osage County. He was a chauffeur part-time, and he chauffeured Molly around, and that's how they met. They seemed to love each other, and they were married. They had two children together. He was a handsome guy. He was a little bit of a ne'er-do-well in the sense that he played poker, and but he professed great love for Molly, and Molly believed that he loved her.
Was there any backlash within the Osage community for marrying outside it?
From the elders, there was some degree, but at this time, intermarriage was becoming more and more common. But Ernest was referred to in a very insulting term as a squaw man, and squaw is a very insulting word for Native Americans, but that's how they would sometimes refer to the whites. And so that kind of stigma, but it was pretty common at that time for intermarriage by the 1920s.
But within a couple of years of their marriage, they had two kids together, and it seemed like everything was going Molly Burkhardt's way.
It seemed like a very happy, she assumed she was happy. They had a nice house. They had two lovely children. And then in 1921, in May, is the first hint that her family is becoming a prime target of this criminal conspiracy.
All right, we're going to talk about that in just a minute with my guest, author David Gran. His new book is called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're listening to Chris's conversation with author David Gran about his latest book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Let's return to the conversation when Chris asked Gran about the beginnings of the murders.
All right, so you left us at the end of the last segment with sort of a cliffhanger. The situation in Osage County seemed to be really good for the Osage, and then people started dying. One of the very first people to disappear was Molly Burkhart's sister.
Yeah, so Molly had an older sister named Anna Brown. She was actually less than a year older. And in May of 1921, she came over to Molly's house. Molly was having a party that day. She visited. She then left the house that evening, and she disappeared. And Molly looked everywhere for her. She had her husband Ernest help look for her. They went to her house. They scoured the reservation. And then a week later, her body was found in a ravine, and she had been shot in the back of the head. And this was, again, one of the first hints that Molly's family was becoming a target.
This would be terrifying in any era, under any circumstance, but murders like this just weren't happening in the heartland on a regular basis in the early 20s.
Well, it was a lawless country, and so there was, because of the money, there was robberies, there was outlawry, but this kind of criminal conspiracy, no. I mean, this became a systematic campaign of murder. And just to give a few more details, not long after Anna Brown disappeared, Molly's sister, her mother grew mysteriously sick. She seemed to grow more insubstantial every day, and within 2 months, she was deceased, and evidence would later suggest that she had been poisoned. So within a span of 2 months, Molly loses not only her sister, she also loses her mother. And then not long after that, Molly had another sister named Rita Smith. And Rita had lived out in the countryside with her white husband and a white maid. And they were so scared during this period, as these murders are starting to take place, that they had moved closer to town to be near Molly. And then one night at about 3 a.m, Molly hears a loud explosion. She wakes up. She's frightened. She goes to the window and she looks out in the direction of her sister's house. And where her sister's house had been, she just sees this large orange ball rising into the sky. And somebody had planted a bomb underneath the house, killing Molly's other sister, Rita, Rita's husband, and this white maid who lived in the house. She was only about 18, and she had 2 children at the time who, because of that, lost their mother. And it was not just Molly's family that was becoming targeted. This period became known as the Osage Reign of Terror.
So it didn't take long for people to realize that there was a pattern here, and the pattern was people were being shot and beaten, people were being poisoned, and people were being blown up with bombs.
Yes, and poisoning became one of the more common means of murder back then, because even though scientists understood toxicologies, there's very poor training in a lot of parts of the country. The judicial system was very primitive in many ways and fragile, the institution. So in most of these cases, the doctors would never do, and the morticians and the scientists, they would never do any kind of toxicology. So poisoning became one of the prime ways to target the Osage. And it wasn't just the Osage. Several of those who tried to catch the killers were themselves killed. There was an attorney who tried to gather evidence. He started to stash the evidence in a safe. He told his wife about him. One day he went to gather evidence from an Osage who was dying of suspected poisoning in Oklahoma City. He then called the sheriff's office and he said, "I've got enough evidence now. I'm coming back on the train." They waited for him to arrive in Osage County. When the train arrived, he was not on it. Everyone began to look for him. Bloodhounds searched the railroad tracks. Boy Scouts took up the search, and his body was later found along the side of the track. Somebody had thrown him off the train, breaking his neck. And he was just one of those who had tried to catch the killers, who himself was killed. And when his wife afterwards went to the hiding spot where all the evidence was supposed to be stored, somebody had already gotten there and cleaned it out.
There was rudimentary law enforcement in the area. I had to, you know, I make notes as I read these books, and I had to read it twice. The investigation of Anna's murder and that of another person was basically closed because they said, we've looked as much as we can, and we can't figure this out.
Yeah. while a few citizens like that lawyer took up the case, the official power structure really performed abysmally. Many of the white authorities neglected the crimes because of prejudice, because the victims were Native Americans. Molly Burkhart showed astonishing courage in crusading for justice while putting a bullseye on her. She would meet with the authorities. She would seek for them to have redress. She put out rewards for the killers. She hired private detectives. But not only was there a lack of training and incompetence, there was a great deal of prejudice, which allowed these cases to be ignored. And on top of that, there was an enormous degree of corruption. I was shocked at how easy it was to tilt the scales of justice back then if you were powerful and wealthy enough.
And private detectives then, no matter how much you paid for them, they were, let's call them an uneven lot.
Yes, the boundary. So private detectives were far more common back then than they were today because of this problem with law enforcement, the fragility of these institutions. So often people would hire PIs to fill the void because they couldn't count on the local police. The problem with the PIs is they often had criminal backgrounds. They too, by privatizing justice, they were often available to the highest bidder. And the boundary with private eyes between a good man and a bad man was extremely porous back then. And many of the private eyes working on the case seemed to be covering up evidence rather than revealing it.
For a while, this remained a horrifying but local story. How did it capture the attention of the nation?
Well, one incident that helped draw more attention to it is there was an oil man who at one point went to Washington, D.C. to hopefully get federal authorities to look into the case. And he checked into a boarding house when he arrived. He received a telegram from a colleague, an associate in Oklahoma, that said, be careful. He carried with him a Bible and a pistol. And he walked out of the boarding house that night, and he was abducted. At some point, somebody put a sack over his head. He was found the next morning in a culvert, and he had been beaten to death and stabbed more than 20 times. And it was then that the Washington Post, a national regional newspaper outside of Oklahoma, reported what the Osage had long known, which is conspiracy to kill rich Indians. So that started to gather more attention. Of course, he was a white victim, which reflects the dichotomy of prejudice in the country at the time, that it was a white victim that helped garner some of this attention. It also showed the breadth and power of the conspirators, that they could hunt down and track somebody down all the way to the capital of the United States. And that really also sparked even greater terror among the Osage. And in 1923, after about more than 24 Osage murders, the tribal council issued a resolution pleading and demanding for federal authorities who would be untainted by local corruption to come in and catch the killers. And it was then that the case finally got the attention of a little-known branch of the Justice Department. It was then called the Bureau of Investigation, but would later be renamed, and we know it as the FBI.
The Bureau of Investigation at the time was not the agency that we know today. It was not the professional organization with, you know, extensive training and specialized functions, but it had this young upstart in charge who wanted to convert it.
Yeah, it had a new boss man. It had been a ragtag organization with very little training. They did not have the power of arrest. They had jurisdiction only over very few cases. And one of the jurisdictions they had was over American Indian reservations, which is why this became one of their first major homicide cases. And they had a new boss man, as some of the agents referred to him, named J. Edgar Hoover. And in 1924, he became the director. He was only 29 years old at the time. He had great visions of building a bureaucratic empire, and he began to remake the Bureau, to professionalize it in many ways. He had, you could see all the seeds of his character in this formative period. He was an organizational genius. He is undoubtedly the greatest and most autocratic bureaucrat that this country has ever produced. He was also paranoid and megalomaniac at the same time. But this case becomes central to him and central to cementing the reputation of the Bureau.
What did the Bureau of Investigation, this proto-FBI, what did they know from murder in the 1920s?
Well, very little. They rarely ever handled murder cases. They were just beginning to adopt more modern techniques like fingerprinting, handwriting analysis. And initially, for the first 2 years, the Bureau actually took up the case in 23. And for 2 years, they the results were disastrous. I mean, agents not only failed to make any arrests in those 2 years, they got an outlaw, a guy named Blackie, out of jail. He's a famous Oklahoma outlaw. And they thought, okay, we'll use this guy as an informant. So they take him out of jail, and they're supposed to keep him under surveillance. They assure the Oklahoma governor and the state officials that we got this covered. Instead, Blackie slips away. He robs a bank and then kills a police officer. And so Hoover is suddenly faced with this threat of a scandal. And while it's hard to believe, Hoover was then insecure about his power. And the Bureau had just come out of a big scandal with Teapot Dome, which was an oil corruption scandal. And so he is worried about his position. And it's then that he summons to Washington a field agent, not from so far from here, from Houston, Texas. He was a Texan, a guy named Tom White. And Tom White gets summoned to headquarters to assume command of this investigation.
Tom White had been a Texas Ranger. You describe him as a frontier lawman.
Yeah, Tom White is, to me, in many ways, like Molly. He reflects the transformation of this country. He was born in a log cabin. He came from a tribal community of lawmen. His father was a sheriff. His brothers were Texas Rangers. He was a Texas Ranger. He was a lawman at a time when a frontier justice, when justice was often meted out by the barrel of a gun. And by the time he's summoned to Washington, though he is defiantly wearing a cowboy hat during that meeting, he has to wear a suit, and he's trying to learn fingerprinting. He has to file paperwork, which he can't stand. So he, in many ways, reflects the transformation of this country. And, of course, when he gets summoned to Washington to take the job, Tom White stands about 6'4", and Hoover was very insecure about his stature. He used to keep a little dais behind his desk. And he actually hated tall agents because they made him look small. And Tom White is looming over him during this encounter while Hoover begins to tell him about the Osage case. And White realizes that Hoover needs him, because even though Hoover is hiring all these new investigators, these college boys who were known as Boy Scouts, they didn't actually have a lot of criminal investigatory experience. And Tom White really did. And so he needs Tom White, who is known as one of the cowboys, to kind of come in and try to hopefully resolve the case.
I don't know about the physical resemblance, but reading the book, I sort of thought about Sam Elliott, the
actor. Yes, yes, yes. He's an astonishing, like this large, strapping, and so were all his brothers. They were all lawmen. He had another brother who was also an FBI agent at the time. And what White does is he realizes the danger, and he begins to put together an undercover team of operatives. He draws from a group of frontier lawmen, again, who are known as the cowboys. And most interestingly, one of them, was an American Indian agent. And even though the Bureau didn't keep statistics back then, I think it's fair to say that he was probably the only American Indian agent in Hoover's Bureau at the time. And they go in, they pose as cattlemen. One poses as an insurance salesman and apparently sold actual policies. I don't know what happened to him, but they did. And they begin to infiltrate the region to try to start to gather evidence.
Tom White took this job seriously.
He did. And this is a story that has evil lurking in the hearts of a number of people, kind of evil that I'm not accustomed, even as a crime writer over many years, to witnessing.
It's saying something from you.
And it also has a lot of goodness. And Molly Burkhart is somebody who has this quiet goodness about her and strength. And Tom White, similarly, these are not flashy individuals. Tom White is not Sherlock Holmes. He's flawed. He's got limited perceptions, but he is dogged and he pursues justice and he has a basic goodness about him. And most importantly, one of the things you realize is that back then it was so easy to tilt the scales of justice. And the good thing when Tom White assumes control of the case is that he can't be bought.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What was it like for the Osage during this time when, you started with 2,000 people in this community and people started getting picked off? It probably felt pretty randomly, except for the fact that they were Osage. How were people trying to protect themselves?
Yeah. So this was known as the Osage Reign of Terror. And I think Reign of Terror is sometimes an overused phrase, but this generally was a Reign of Terror. The Osage would not let their children wander the streets alone. At night, they would string lights around the houses to hollow out the dark because they were so afraid. They purchased guns. Many Osage moved away, and later Osage, who I spoke to today, refer to it as a diaspora. It was a terrifying time, and nobody knew who would be next. And what was so dangerous about this is that you didn't know who to trust. And I think that it's one of the things I wanted to try to convey in the book is that, you know, it's one thing when there's when you kind of know who's coming at you. And this is a case where it was so difficult for so many people to know who was conspiring, who was complicit. You didn't know who to trust. And that added a level of genuine terror.
Even before arrests had been made, there was this creeping sense that the killer was somewhere among them in the community.
Yes, and that also added to a level of terror, that this was not just an outsider, not just an outlaw who roamed in and robbed the store. It was clear that somebody was targeting to get the wealth of head rights and get the oil money. And that it became increasingly clear by the level of knowledge, by the way families were being systematically wiped out, that this was someone among them.
For Molly Burkhart, I can't imagine what her life was like as these mysteries began to be solved.
Yeah, so at a certain point, White and his men, essentially, there are many twists to the investigation. And in many ways, it was less like a criminal investigation than like an espionage case. There are moles, there are double agents, there's possibly a triple agent. The reports are being leaked, they're being followed. They, too, don't know who to trust because they realize that there is a power structure here that is complicit in the crimes. And so it's hard to know who in authority may be working against them and who's working with them. But ultimately, they follow the money in many of the cases, and they follow the money in the case of Molly Burkhart's family, and it leads them right to her doorstop. It leads her right to inside her house, and it turns out that Ernest Burkhart, one of the men who was conspiring, who was a participant, was Molly's husband, and that Molly had assumed that he loved her, and instead, all that time, he had been part of a conspiracy directed by his uncle, who was one of the most powerful people in the community, to systematically eliminate the family so that they could inherit the head rights. And even after all the years of working on it, I can't fathom how that must have felt for Molly to realize that the people who she thought loved her were the very people trying to kill her and her family and her children even.
My guest is New Yorker staff writer David Gran. We're talking about his new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. We'll resume our conversation in 2 minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're listening to Chris's conversation with author David Gran about his latest book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Let's return to the conversation when Gran talked about the difficulty of digging into events that happened more than 100 years ago.
David, remarkably, your research to tell this story included Freedom of Information Act requests, we call them FOIA requests,
yes,
more than a century after these events took place.
Yes. So I did Freedom of Information Acts to any government institution that might have had possible papers, including FBI, the Department of the Interior. Some of these documents are still blacked out and redacted, which is kind of absurd given the length of time. I was fortunate enough to get a lawman to leak me some of the Bureau, give me the Bureau papers that were unredacted. Hoover's penchant for secrecy still remains. And so some of the stuff, for example, about Blackie Thompson and these kind of embarrassments were kind of cut out or papered over. And it also involved getting not only documents and going to archives, including in Fort Worth, Texas, which has a branch of the National Archives there. And I was able to find a lot of records there, including the secret grand jury testimony to the case that I don't think had been made public before. I also was able to track down descendants of many of the murderers and the victims who were able to give me oral histories as well as more documents. And it was only through that process, which took close to 5 years, I was able to gather enough to really reconstruct what happened.
This is a really fascinating aspect of it, because there are, you know, the facts that exist in these period documents, but there are descendants alive, and this is important, there are descendants alive of the people who were killed, and there are descendants alive of the people who did the killing.
Yes, and I really see this story as a microcosm of the clash of civilizations that played out in this country, and a microcosm in many ways of the formation and birth of this country, not just of law enforcement. And the fact that you have to this day living in neighborhoods, descendants of the victims and descendants of the murderers, sometimes living just down the street from each other, is partly, and their fates are now intertwined. I think that is partly the story of this country. I spoke to an Osage elder who said of some of the descendants of the murderers who lived nearby, she said, sometimes they're not fully aware of what their grandparents or parents did. Sometimes they just don't want to talk about it. She said, which I thought showed a great deal of forgiveness on her part, she said, you know, we don't hold them responsible for the blood on their ancestors' hands. I thought that involved a level of forgiveness. In one case of a descendant of the murderers, a descendant of Ernest Burkhart, and what's important to understand is in these crimes, you had the perpetrators and the victims living in the same houses often. Hmm. So it's not just even the same neighborhoods. I mean, for example, I tracked down Molly Burkhart's granddaughter, Margie Burkhart, who's a lovely woman, and she told me what it was like to grow up without cousins, to not have aunts, how deeply and profoundly it affected her father, who was a little boy growing up in that house of secrets, those sinister secrets. He referred to his father as old dynamite because his father had participated in the bombing. So he's calling his father old dynamite. That was his nickname. And she gave me a picture, and I thought, and the picture's in the book, but I found it so striking because it shows her father and Molly's other child, and there's a picture of Ernest Burkhart, but somebody had ripped the face off of Ernest Burkhart, but they kept the picture. So you could see his two children standing side by side with half of Ernest's body because the memory was so painful that their own father had lived in the house and been one of the killers. And here they had ripped it out. And I thought that photograph just tells you how this is still living history, how it still reverberates to this day. And in the case of one of the descendants of the murderers who I was able to speak with, he later sent me a note, and he was pretty candid, and I was struck by this. He said, I'm very ashamed of what my relatives had done, and I hope when you see the Osage, you express that to them for me.
I wonder what it's like for people who know that this is part of their legacy and, as you said, sort of continue to live in the same community. Are the Osage who are walking around in 2017, do they all know this story much better than most of the rest of America until reading this book?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. So when I described that picture that was cut out at the Osage Nation Museum, that picture had been removed by the Osage not to forget, as so many Americans had, but because they can't forget. They know this history. They certainly know the broad outlines. Families know about suspicious deaths in the family. They may not have all the details, but this is a history that they get passed down and that they are aware of. And one of the things that motivated me in trying to write the book was to address the fact that people like me were shockingly ignorant of it.
Lots of these murders remained unsolved. Lots of collaborators, possibly even people who had literal blood on their hands, were not brought to justice. But as you mentioned, Molly Burkhart's husband did go to prison. What did this do for the reputation of the Bureau of Investigation?
Well, so Hoover really used it early on to kind of cement the need for this national law enforcement and to cement his reputation. He used the case and tried to mythologize himself. Of course, he never gave credit to Tom White or any of the undercover operatives. And I thought one of the great ironies was I found the only record I could find of anyone thanking Tom White and naming the undercover operatives on the case was the Osage Tribal Council, which issued a resolution thanking them. Hoover took the credit for himself.
And Hoover thanked them in private. He just wouldn't let anybody else know that
he did not want anyone
else
to know. He wanted Hoover that Hoover was responsible. And then, of course, by the 30s, Hoover is quickly remaking the Bureau and then gets, because of the war on crime and Dillinger, suddenly the Bureau's power expands. But this was really part of its early formation. It was a seminal case in the formation of the Bureau and one of the seminal cases in the evolution of law enforcement in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about law enforcement being conducted at a time when fingerprints were new technology, when not everybody had access to accurate toxicology.
Yeah, there weren't crime labs. Training was often really poor. You know, you have a high school education with no formal training and you could carry a badge and, you know, you might get a couple witnesses and chase a killer, but you were not taught in anything like scientific detection, handwriting analysis because of a forged deeds and forged wills. Handwriting became very important in this case, and some of the early handwriting analysis, you could see the reports from it. But that was a pivotal part in helping to solve the case.
So Tom White wrapped up his part of the investigation. He was not near ready for retirement. Where did he go next?
So Tom White then became warden of Leavenworth after this case. And one of the weird twists of fate is that right when he became warden after solving and catching at least some of these killers, these criminals are sent to Leavenworth. And so he actually greets the men he had just convicted. And White, as a warden, is a pretty remarkable figure because I was able to get letters from many of the prisoners. And I'll just tell you one story because I think it illuminates who he was and his character. He is at one point taken hostage during a prison escape, and several prisoners take him out of the Leavenworth. They're holding him hostage, and he gets shot. He's left to bleed out on the road. He's then taken to a hospital where they believe he's going to die. And he gives an order to the prison for some of the to the prison officials that some of the prisoners who were caught not to touch them, because he knew they would, if you touched the warden back then, they would, you know, beat the living hell out of you. And one of the prisoners I was able to find an oral history gave to a historian saying how that was the only reason we didn't have our heads cracked in. And that prisoner, when he later got out of jail, when he was an old man, he went to visit Tom White and they became friends. And he said, you know, he was the most, you know, one hell of a man. The greatest man he ever knew was Tom White.
Did White write anything or talk a lot about his experiences in Osage Country?
You know, he hoped at some point to write something. It was never published. He worked with another writer. He wanted to get a nonfiction book about it. I was able to find the unpublished version of it. But his role really got eclipsed from history, just the same way the story of Molly got eclipsed. I mean, when you read about one of the things that I found so shocking, one of the reasons the story is rooted around these two individuals because they are the people who got lost and written out of history, erased from history, and they shouldn't be. Molly, when she's mentioned in the murder, she's usually just one sentence. She has no agency. Here's the person at the very center of this criminal conspiracy, and she's just a line. She's just a name. And so, you know, I'm limited by what I can find from the historical records, but I wanted the best I could based on the records to convey what this was really like, what it was like to experience this and to live through this conspiracy. And what it was like for Tom White as well.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's hardly a happy ending to this story, but Molly did find love again.
She did. Molly remarried, and according to her descendants, she was happy in that marriage. And one of the more striking documents I found in an archive was, I think it was from 1934. It was right around then. It was just a couple years before Molly died. And she had appealed her quote-unquote incompetency. That had made her have a guardian. In her case, her guardian had been Ernest. Ernest Burkhardt, her husband.
Isn't that convenient?
Isn't that convenient, exactly. And that was part of the plot. And she had appealed it, and she was finally, quote-unquote, according to the court, deemed competent. So just about 2 years before Molly died of natural causes, she is suddenly, at last, a full-fledged citizen with the rights that she should have always had and finally has control of the money and her own fortune.
I want to know how members of the Osage Nation that you visited and worked with, how they felt about this guy from the New Yorker coming in and telling their story.
You know, I'm always very wary of speaking for others, and I think, you know, so I don't know. And I wouldn't always ask them, you know, why are you talking to me? But what I can say is that in all my interactions, they were so wonderfully open and generous. They shared with me their stories. I worked on it for a long period of time, and over the time became friends with many of them. In many cases, they had lived with the ambiguity of suspicious deaths in their family. I think it's important to understand that while the Bureau did catch some of the killers, there was a much deeper conspiracy that was left unexposed, and many collaborators and conspirators got away. And this was less a case about who did it than who didn't do it. And it's very disturbing in that regard. And many of the Osage had lived with these unresolved deaths, and they would often give me bits of evidence, hoping I could bring some resolution if possible. And I'm heading out there next week. I know Margie has read the book, Molly's granddaughter, and was very grateful to me for the portrait of Molly. And that, in a way, you know, my hope is, you know, with history, you want to bring some accounting. And part of that accounting is to hopefully record and memorialize the voices of the victims that has been lost.
What's happened to the wealth of the Osage Nation?
So much of the oil money was swindled. Head rights were swindled through these criminal conspiracies. And then the Great Depression came and wiped out some fortunes. And over time, a lot of the oil in Osage County has just been depleted from the land. And so they're not getting the same kind of revenues. If you have a inheritance of a partial head right at this point, you know, you might earn anywhere from a few thousand, maybe during a boom time, $40,000, something like that a year. But you're not making millions of dollars. But the Osage are a very resilient nation. I think it's really important to point that out. They have about 4,000 Osage who live in Osage County and about 20,000 members of the Osage Nation who live elsewhere in the country. They have their own democratic institutions. They have court systems. They have taken they've learned from their history. They've passed legislation to make it not possible you have to be at least half Osage to inherit a head right. And as one Osage lawyer told me, you know, we were victims of these crimes, but we do not live as victims. And they've also found other resources for income, including casinos, which they use for education and health benefits.
Has there been a return to a full practice of Osage traditions that was discouraged 100 years ago?
Yeah, the Osage have definitely put an emphasis, even they now have people trying to reclaim the language that had been lost, the Osage language, which is really important anthropologically. And they still do dances regularly every year, and I would visit them, and it was a great time because so many Osage from around the country would visit. And yeah, as I said, it's a very resilient, at least from my impressions during my visits, and they have very strong democratic institutions, which is wonderful.
The last time you and I talked, it was about your book, The Lost City of Z, which if it sounds familiar to people who didn't read the book, there's a narrative film out now.
Yes. So I think back then I probably thought when we spoke, because I knew they were trying to make a movie, I thought the movie would be out in a year, and then another year went by and another year. And I came to discover that it's basically harder to get a movie made than it is to hump through the jungle looking for a lost city. but yes, a movie has come out. It's directed and written by James Gray. It's produced by Brad Pitt's Plan B, and it stars Charlie Hunnam and Robert Pattinson and Sienna Miller. And I'm probably that rare author who was extremely happy with the movie. I thought it was terrific.
Oh, that's great. Did you watch the first time? Did you sort of watch through your fingers? Were you concerned?
Well, I wouldn't say watching my fingers, but when you first watch it, you're just like, oh, they did that. Oh, they didn't do that. Oh, they did this. And so you're just, you definitely have a strange interaction with it, because you're just like, oh, you're just literally interpreting based on an adaptation. And then the second time I saw it was at the New York Film Festival, and it was nice. I could just watch it as a piece of art and actually just experience it as a film.
David Gran is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His newest book is Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.